Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I am very glad you have tuned us in. Listen to this ad that ran in the Christian Recorder in Philadelphia on July 24th, 1865. Information wanted. Can anyone inform me of the whereabouts of John Person, the son of Hannah Person of Alexandria, Virginia, who belonged to the Alexander Sanctor? I have not seen him for 10 years. I was sold to Joseph Bruin, who took me to New Orleans. My name was then Hannah Person. It is now Hannah Cole. This is the only child I have, and I desire to find him much. Any information of his whereabouts can be directed to Hannah Cole, Cedar Street, New Bedford, Massachusetts. Following the end of the Civil War, African-American families who had been separated by slavery and war sought ways to reunite. Black newspapers across the country ran ads placed by people looking for their families and friends. These ads had details that might trigger a memory, the names of slave owners and traders, ideas about where lost relatives may have ended up, and often ended with a plea for ministers to read the ad aloud to their congregations. In this hour, we'll hear these stories of separation, the devastation of a husband sold away from his wife, a mother sold away from her son, and the great efforts people made to learn any news about their lost family members. From traveling great distances to asking previous owners for information, letters, newspaper ads, and diary entries preserved from the 19th century reveal the pain, frustration, and hope of African Americans searching for their loved ones. Later this hour, we'll hear from a local genealogist who traced her family's past back to the Civil War and its aftermath, discovering sisters who reunited after the war and uncovering the truth behind an old piece of family lore. But joining me right now is historian Heather Williams, a presidential term professor and professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's written several books, including Help Me Find My People, The African-American Search for Family Lost in Slavery. Professor Williams will be speaking at the Reginald Lewis Museum here in Baltimore tomorrow. A link to that event is available on the Midday Show page at WYPR.org. Welcome to the show, Dr. Williams.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you can join us. Tell us more about these Information Wanted ads.
Well, I started to come across them when I was a graduate student doing research on African-American education during slavery and after. And they were in newspapers, many of them in newspapers that Black people started publishing in the South, just local newspapers. But also, you mentioned the Christian Recorder, which is the publication of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, so the AME Church. And that's a paper that had been published for several decades in Philadelphia before the end of the Civil War. But as soon as the war ended, the ad that you read was July 1865. The war ended in April of 1865. Mm-hmm. People started placing ads in newspapers looking for family members. And so I first came across them as I was doing research on another project, and I found them just compelling and poignant, and at first very sad because I found 400 of them in one summer, and over time I found about 1,200 of them. But sometimes people had been separated for 20 years, 25 years. So Thornton Copeland had been sold from Fauquier County in Virginia to Tennessee, and he was looking for his mother. He hadn't seen her in 21 years, and he said her name was Betty. So she didn't have a last name, and he knew that even her first name may have changed. And so he gave the names of their owners, of the people who had been the traders who purchased and sold them, thinking that perhaps these white men would have more of a public face and that people would know their names and recognize their names, and someone might be able to say, upon hearing this ad or reading this ad, oh, I remember that General Johnson's slaves went to a particular place, or I remember a Betty who used to belong to that person. And so they used physical descriptions, ages. You find lots of mothers and fathers searching for their young children who by now, you know, you're looking for an 8-year-old who might now be 20 years old or 16. And so I found them just really powerful and sad. But then I started to see that there was also hope embedded in them, because for Thornton Copeland, a former slave, to now pay money to place an ad in a newspaper meant that he really had some hope that his mother was still alive and that somebody would be able to find her. And the other aspect that I began to see was a sort of resilience in that people had survived these separations, but also a persistence of caring and a persistence of love, so that even though you had lived, you had gone on, sometimes husbands and wives had formed other relationships, often people were still caring. They had other children after being moved from Virginia to Alabama, for instance, but they still wanted to find the children they had lost years or sometimes decades earlier. And so even though each ad is very short, you know, you just read that one, and it's sometimes just a few sentences, especially when you read many of them and put them into a broader historical context, you can see the power that's in them and that they carried so much on behalf of the people who were searching.
You mentioned the investment, the cost of placing an ad like this. Do you have any sense, and I'm sure it varied from newspaper to newspaper, but do you have any sense of how that cost would have compared to what a former slave might have been able to earn? I mean, was this a big cost?
It's everything for them was a big cost, because they were turned out of slavery, most of them, with nothing. And so a man might expect to make $7 in a month, and an ad would cost sometimes a quarter, sometimes a dollar. Not all of the newspapers listed the cost. And one newspaper said they wouldn't accept any payment. There was no need to pay for it. Hmm. But for some of them, it would have been a dollar or a quarter or 50 cents. And these are people who were also trying to send children to school and maybe paying a dollar a month for that, and just trying to scrounge together a living. So it was a sacrifice, and possibly why we don't even see more of these ads.
I had assumed from reading many of the ads in your book, so many of them end with a line like, NB, ministers, please read in church. NB, ministers in the South, please read in our churches. So I was assuming that these were ads primarily aimed at other former slaves, many of whom would probably still have been illiterate, since literacy was forbidden for the most part. Slaves, while they were slaves, were not allowed to learn to read. But you just mentioned the extent to which some of the ads have the names of former owners, and was there a hope that that whites would join in this search to help reconnect a formerly enslaved person with their family?
Well, I think you're right that they were primarily aimed at other black people, other former slaves, free, you know, people who may have even been free before slavery ended. But they're naming the owners because, let's say, 100 people had been sold from a particular plantation. They're trying to jar some kind of memory. Somebody may have been sold along with Thornton Copeland's mother and may have gone to the same location. So they really were aiming primarily at African Americans. And as you say, they say, please read this in the church, because most slave states had made it illegal to teach enslaved people to read or write, and sometimes even free people of color to read and write, and had punished either both the teacher and the student. And so many people did not acquire literacy, but some did, because they really found ways to undermine the law. But in any community after slavery ended, most people would not have been literate. And there would have been possibly just the one newspaper coming into the community. So the Christian Recorder, for instance, would have gone to the AME church. In many of these communities, you had one Black Baptist church and one Methodist church. And so the newspaper would have gone to one person. And so if you could read it aloud to a congregation, maybe 50 people would hear it, maybe 100 people. Maybe you'd read it during Sunday service and Wednesday prayer meeting. And so that they hoped that the words would circulate and that the pleas for help would circulate then outside. Those people would leave church and go home and talk about what had been said and which ad and who they were looking for, and in that way circulate information throughout the community.
So many of the ads talk about finding children from yes. whom someone now writing had been separated, either siblings separated in childhood or a parent searching for a child or a child searching for a parent. I realize that aggregate statistics are almost impossible to formulate about slavery, but how widespread during slavery was separation of children from their families?
It is hard to come up with exact numbers, but there's a historian by the name of Michael Tadman who's estimated that in the domestic slave trade from the upper South to the lower South, so from places like Virginia, from Maryland, from parts of North Carolina to Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, as slavery expanded, and Texas, you know, slavery went farther south and west. People who had been growing tobacco, for instance, in Virginia, they were excess at this point. They didn't need as many people to do that work. And so they started selling them, say, in the 1810s, 1820s, to the Deep South. And so in just that aspect of the domestic slave trade, he estimates that about 1 million children experienced separation from one or both parents. And that could be through the sale of the child from both parents or from one parent, or the sale of one or both of the parents. And so about 1 million children. And I don't even know.
As a proportion of all the kids in slavery, what would that have been?
I don't know what the proportion is, because this is a number that's over a period of time. Uh-huh. You know, it's not a static number. So you're talking about movement from let's say 1820 to 1861 or so. And so Tadman may have a proportion, but I don't remember what that proportion is. But at the end of slavery, we know that there were about 4 million people who were freed through the 13th Amendment and the end of the Civil War.
The second chapter of Help Me to Find My People is, you've titled, Let No Man Put Asunder, the line from so many marriage ceremonies. What was the status of marriage among slaves? Were they able to be married?
They called it marriage, but they were not able to legally marry. Slaves were considered property, but they were also considered persons in many ways, so that they could be held and were held responsible for criminal acts, for instance. However, they were not considered legal persons who could enter into contracts. And that's what marriage is. You know, we have a lot of flowers and we have celebration, but we're entering into a contract with someone. And that's why you then have to go through another proceeding to end that contract. If you want to end your marriage, there has to be a formal divorce. And so they were not considered legally capable of entering into these marriages. So they got married. Some of them fell in love with each other, chose partners, but they had to go to their owners to get permission. Very often the man belonged to a different owner than the woman, and so would have to go to two people to get permission to get married. And always the understanding was that that marriage could be dissolved by the owner if the owner decided to sell the people apart. Or, for instance, if the woman were not reproducing an owner might decide that she needed to be with a different man so that he could have more children born who would belong to him, because children belong to the owner of the mother. And so there was no legal recognition of these marriages. And as I said, it's a legal question of whether they could legally enter into contracts, but it was also a very important social question that allowing enslaved people to become married, would have really legally married, would have challenged the hierarchy that was necessary to keep slavery in place. Because if a man in 19th century America were married, he would be considered responsible for supporting his family. Well, how are you going to support your family when your labor is claimed by the product of your labor is claimed by someone else?
We need to take a short break here. I want to continue this conversation. That is historian Heather Williams telling us about research that she did for her book, Help Me to Find My People. We'll continue with Heather Williams after this break. We'll also meet a genealogist who lives here in Maryland who has researched her family and can give us some ideas how to go about it. And you can be part of this conversation. Have stories been passed down in your family about relatives separated by slavery or by the Civil War? We'd love to hear from you. Call us at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. An ad placed in the Southwestern Christian Advocate from 1877 reads in part, "I will be most thankful for information concerning my two sisters, Phyllis and Letitia, called Tisha. Our mother is named Itty and formerly belonged to Billy Carter. My sisters were sold to a slave trader named Pat Anderson, and we afterwards heard that he sold Phyllis 15 miles below New Orleans. This was the last word we had concerning them. Address Mrs. Martha Smith, care Reverend Joseph Smith, Lebanon, Texas." African Americans separated by the slave trade and the Civil War sought to reunite with family and friends by placing ads in local newspapers, writing to previous owners, traveling across the country, anything they could do to connect. Today we're discussing their stories and how people today can uncover their family's roots. We've been speaking with historian Heather Williams, presidential term professor and professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's author of the book, Help Me to Find My People, The African American Search for Family Lost in Slavery. And now Angela Walton-Raji has joined us. Angela Walton-Raji is author of several books on African American and Native American genealogy. Angela Walton-Raji teaches a monthly genealogy course with the Historical Society of Baltimore County, and you can find more of her genealogical research at AfricanRootsPodcast.com. We will link to that from the Midday page at WIPR. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So, your ancestry is both African American and American Indian.
That's correct.
How did you always know that growing up, or did you discover it?
Well, I grew up in western Arkansas, right on the border of Oklahoma and Arkansas. My dad is from Oklahoma. My mom is from Arkansas. And growing up so close to my dad's side of the family in particular, it was always known we're Choctaw, we're part Choctaw. My great-grandmother, who was my babysitter until I went to kindergarten, she spoke the Choctaw language, and she would have a brother who would come to visit her once in a while. I think I maybe saw him twice in my childhood, but they would speak in the backyard in their native tongue, which was the Choctaw language. And so that was something that's common. Fort Smith, Arkansas, just about everybody who lives there has some ties to either Cherokee or Choctaw Nation.
And so your black ancestors, your African American ancestors were slaves,
yes,
to the American Indians.
That's correct. My Choctaw ancestors were Choctaw freedmen, And my great-grandmother, whom I knew, this was a real surprise when I discovered the actual records at the National Archives in 1991. And Nana died in 1961. So this is 30 years later. And I'm just doing a genealogical thing. And I decided to pull some records of Choctaw Freedmen. And, of course, had I really stared at the word Freedmen, it would have been clear what that meant. But when I got the document, and there it was, Sally Walton, slave of Emmeline Perry. And that was a surprise for me, I was born in the 50s, and to think that I had met someone in my lifetime, because she died in 1961.
Sally Walton.
She was born in 1863. She was 98 years old when she died. Uh-huh. And she had been born a slave. She was born in the middle of the war. And the Choctaw Nation, as did other tribes, did not officially abolish the institution of slavery, and we're talking black chattel slavery. This is not, come in, my brother, let me protect you from this horrible, peculiar institution. No, this was Southern slavery. These are individuals who were removed west on the Trail of Tears, individuals who fought with the South in the Civil War. The Indians all signed treaties with the Southern Confederate Army, and out of about 28 Indian regiments in the Civil War coming out of Indian Territory, only three were Union. The remaining 25 units were all Confederate Indian regiments. They were slaveholders. They were Southerners. When we're referring to Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, and Seminole nations.
And most of those tribes, then, after slavery was abolished, made the former slaves members of the tribe, correct?
Some did, yes. A part of the Treaty of 1866, which was signed in Fort Smith, Arkansas, in fact, was to, number one, abolish the institution, but also to adopt the freedmen as members of the tribe. Four of the five tribes did. The Chickasaw Nation never did. And Chickasaw freedmen are frequently called a people without a country. They were not American citizens until Oklahoma entered the United States as a state in 1907.
That is Angela Walton Raji, a genealogist, speaking about her own genealogy here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us on the line is Heather Williams, an historian and the author of Help Me to Find My People, The African-American Search for Family Lost in Slavery. You can be part of this conversation by sending us an email at midday@wypr.org or by phoning us at 410-662-8780. And we have some calls. Steve is calling us from Baltimore. Steve, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Professor Williams. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I can barely hear you, so I'll ask my question. I'll hang up. I think my question was partially answered by that advertisement that you read, but generally, if somebody placed an ad in a newspaper, what was the hope or expectation as to how they would be contacted? In other words, how did they anticipate, or what were they thinking? What was the best way that they could be contacted? They'd leave addresses, or was it generally they listed their church or their pastor? I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you, Professor.
Steve,
I appreciate the
phone call. Professor Williams, could you hear Steve's question about how people expected to be contacted?
In the ads, people always gave an address and often a post office box. Sometimes they asked a response to be sent to a particular minister. And the ads really show how significant ministers and churches were in these communities. The church really was the primary institution in these communities in which people had church. They were just kind of gathering places. And so they would always say where they should be contacted. Sometimes they asked for information to be sent to the newspaper in which the ad was placed. So the Colored Tennessean in Nashville, for instance, people would say, address a response to the post office box of the newspaper.
And so, of course, they were hoping for a letter response, and we have no way of knowing how often they got one.
Right, exactly.
Because we had another caller who couldn't stay with us, but posed exactly that question, which is, do we have, aside from how, not knowing particular response to newspaper ads, in general, from your research, Professor Williams, do you assume that most of these searches did not end with a successful connection?
Yeah, my sense is that most people did not find their family members, but I have no way of knowing in most cases. In some instances, I see evidence of reunification. I don't necessarily see the separation as it's happening, but I see when people connect. But I think there was a lot more separation and searching than there was reunification. But most people who found each other somehow returned to where they had last seen their family members. You know, there's a reporter from The Nation who met a man in North Carolina who said he had walked about 600 miles from Georgia, heading back to his town in North Carolina where he had left family members years earlier. And even when we get that close, I don't get to see whether he found his family or not. So he was a day's walk away from home, but I don't know what he found when he got there. And so most people did not document reunifications. Most people didn't document. Most of these people really lived their lives in obscurity when we think about a historical record. Mm-hmm. And so we don't see it. But in some slave narratives, we do get information about reunification and some letters and journals from missionaries, white missionaries who went to the South, who interacted with people.
And left some record of whether families had been reunited.
Of whether they had been reunited, and then also raising some of the problems that arose if you had been separated from a husband or a wife for 10 years. Maybe the mate you had been looking for had moved on. What kinds of decisions and choices would people make? Would children recognize their parents? Would parents recognize the children because they were looking for an 8-year-old and now the person is 15 or 18? And so it was not, even when you found family members, it could be complicated.
Angela Walton-Raja, you've done a lot of genealogical research. What goes through your mind when you hear Professor Williams say the searches that we seem to think probably worked were the ones where people didn't do it, they may have put out an ad, they may have gotten a response, a letter or something, but basically they walked back to the last place they had been with this family member and tried to search it out.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I know from my own experience in terms of research and on a different line in my family, there was separation, but the separation was wartime. Separation in the middle of the war, 1864, Union soldiers had come in through this town in northern Mississippi, and any able-bodied man was able to gain freedom by becoming a Union soldier. And my great-great-grandmother's husband, well, my great-great-grandfather, he went with the blue soldiers, as she used to tell the story. Yeah, he went with the blue soldiers,
the Union.
He never came back, yes. But also her son left. And so did her father. So she lost all three men in her life in one night. And
this was not by being sold away. This was
because this was wartime. They were suddenly recruiting U.S. colored troops. This is 1864. The Bureau of U.S. Colored Troops was established in 63. And Ripley, Mississippi, Tippah County, there was a raid that had been sent down from Corinth in northeast Mississippi. And this little hamlet, they went through. The white men were gone. They were in the Confederate Army off somewhere fighting. Even the overseers were gone. So there was opportunity. And so there was separation in anticipation. Well, he'll come back. He'll come back after the war. And he never came back. And in the pension file, and I know Dr. Williams mentioned that she's used pension files, it's heartbreaking because, as she said, as she kept trying for decades, trying to find out what happened to her husband and to try and get a pension, but not even knowing his regiment, she was not going to be successful. But then she talked about what happened when the Yankees came. And then she said, these words sort of haunt me. I wrote about it on one of my blogs. I ain't seed them no more. And three men in her life, her son, her father, and her husband. And I myself have looked for them. And I don't know what happened. I think they're from one of the people who was a soldier later in Memphis, years later, he thinks that he maybe saw them go down in a fight, in the Guntown fight, or there was some steamship that went down, but it's not known, and she never knew the regiment, so she was not successful until she died. She was seeking her husband.
Now, are we talking about your great-grand?
My great-great, my mother's great-grandmother.
And this is Amanda Young.
Yes, that is correct.
And she was reunited with her sister.
Yes, and that was totally unexpected in her quest to find her husband. Again, imagining, we don't have an imagination. We don't have an imagination of war on American soil because it's been 150 years since the Civil War ended. So we don't have that image. The only image we have of war is what we see in the evening news with refugees running, you know, sort of lost. Well, that happened in the South, and many of those refugee people were slaves who suddenly could walk on the road. And when the soldiers left that morning, and it's all in that pension file, some of the younger women followed their husbands, and they followed the regiment, and they became contrabands. They lived in contraband camps. She, the sister who went and followed her own husband, never returned either to Ripley, Mississippi. Years later, Amanda's now an old lady. Her daughter had moved to Memphis. She moved to Memphis to live with her daughter. Now all the children are grown, and she's still trying to get a pension for her husband. And a soldier hears her tell that story and said, wait a minute, I know somebody from Ripley, Mississippi. I think we go to the same church. And suddenly they were put together, and there was the testimony of the younger sister, Para Lee, and who says, yes, I am Amanda's sister, her full sister, and we have not seen each other for 50 years. And I can only imagine I don't even know if it's joy, if it's shock. The emotion just still has me stunned. I think about it all the time.
Yeah,
and,
it is stunning.
I've been trying to write about that because it's still inside of me to try and imagine what that had to have been like all those decades.
Professor Williams, one of the things that struck me as I read parts of your book was that for many families, this search went on for decades. It was not just 1865 through the 60s, maybe into the 1870s. It seemed like people were searching on into the 20th century.
Exactly. The last ads that I've seen were placed in 1903. And so the separations had taken place before 1865. Some, you know, Angela's been talking about wartime separation, enlisting in the army, but people were still being sold during the war, or the white owners moved and took people with them. So these separations took place before 1865, and in 1903, people were still placing ads, hoping that they could still find a living person, an aunt, an uncle, a mother, a sister, a sibling.
We're going to take another short break here. Still lots more to talk about with Dr. Heather Andrea Williams, author of Help Me to Find My People, and with Angela Walton-Raji, who's written several books and who teaches a monthly genealogy course with the Historical Society of Baltimore County. And you can be part of this conversation. Do you know if any of your relatives were reunited after the Civil War? Have you tried to face your family roots? We're going to talk some about that when we get back. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about attempts by African Americans to reunite with family and friends after the end of slavery, the end of the Civil War. Does your family have stories about family members who were separated? Have you tried to track down where family members may have been lost? You can be part of this conversation. You can email us at midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. 1880. I'm speaking with historian Heather Williams, professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the book Help Me to Find My People, The African-American Search for Family Lost in Slavery. And with me here in the studio is Angela Walton Raji, author of several books on African-American and Native American genealogy. She teaches a monthly genealogy course with the Historical Society of Baltimore County. Professor Williams, we were talking about marriage earlier, and you write about Henry Bibb, a fugitive from slavery who went on to give anti-slavery lectures. He was able to be married, right?
Well, he got married. He first, in his narrative, he said that as a young man, he said, I'm never getting married because marriage will tie me to the institution of slavery. And indeed, the people who were more likely to escape were young men who did not have, had not formed a new family. So they didn't have a wife or children. And so he wanted to stay free of these kinds of connections, emotional connections that would keep him enslaved. But he met a woman named Melinda, an enslaved woman. They fell in love. They got married. And they attempted to escape slavery several times because he said that before he agreed to marry her, they had to discuss this idea that they would not forever be enslaved. And she said, yes, she also wanted to leave. But their marriage was the kind of marriage that enslaved people were allowed to have, so that it was not a legal marriage. It was not legally recognized by the state. So they attempted to escape several times, and I mean, it's a very sad story because once she ended up being caught and was owned by a man, and Bibb went back trying to get her and take her out of slavery and got a message through her mother or from her mother saying that she was okay, she was fine. They had a child, by the way, and so he was separated from his child and from Melinda.
The child was with Melinda.
With Melinda. Mm-hmm. And he certainly thought that there was some relationship, some kind of concubinage relationship, so that the owner was now claiming Melinda as his, you know, as somebody with whom he had a relationship. And so Bibb finally left and escaped to Canada, where he became an abolitionist, wrote a journal, but published a newspaper in which he gave help to people who were trying to escape to Canada. So in the newspaper, you'd see the schedule for the boat that crosses from Ohio into Canada, for instance. But he also wrote a poem that I include in the book in which you can see this longing. He remarried, but he was still kind of longing for a wife who had been lost in slavery. Mm.
It is a sad story. Angela Walton Raji, you have traced a story with a happier ending. Can you and part of what's wonderful about the story that you have blogged about is that you walked. You walk people in that blog post through every step of how you learned it, which we don't have time to do. But can you tell us about Cephas?
Uncle Cephas, yes. Uncle Cephas was my great-grandfather's brother. And his name was a name that none of us knew until a family reunion. And my last living uncle, my grandmother's youngest brother, who was still alive in 1989, he's the one who finally told us who this uncle was. His name was Cephas. We had a story about him, and the story was that, well, we have this uncle who shot a white man and ran away to Texas. That's all we knew. And so it's like, okay, this guy living in Tennessee ran away to Texas. As it turned out, yes, he did shoot someone, but he shot someone defending the family from Knight Riders. This is Giles County, Tennessee, home and birthplace of the Klan, 30 miles from Pulaski. And they were attacked, as many families were in Tennessee in the 1880s, was when this incident took place. And it was hard to get the uncle to tell his name because we can't say it. They may go find him and kill him. And finally someone said, Uncle George, they're dead. So you could tell us the name.
But the ethic was so strong in the family.
Yes,
not
absolutely.
To mention this,
here was
this
an elderly
uncle's name.
Man still obeying his parents, not to mention the name. fast forward, on a whim, I went looking for Uncle Cephas in the records. And on a whim, I decided, wonder if he was a soldier. There were a lot of Civil War soldiers from Tennessee and Alabama, U.S. colored troops, Union soldiers. And sure enough, I found a soldier called Cephas Bass. I, of course, spent some time. The next available date I could take off to get to the National Archives and pulled a pension file. For him to be my Cephas Bass, he had to have had some tie to Tennessee. Here was an index card that said he was applying for a pension from Texas. What did I know about Uncle Cephas? He shot somebody and ran away to Texas. Well, I pulled out the file, and sure enough, there it was. I was born in Giles County, Tennessee. I enlisted with my brother, Braxton, and of course, as a genealogist, I'm going, who? What? What? There's another brother. And I enlisted with my two sons, Henry and Emmanuel. Here are two additional, and of course, a genealogist is in heaven when they get more names of the family that we never knew, that did not survive. Well, what was even more amazing was the fact that he talked about the fact that he and his unit, his regiment, which is true, I verified it in the official records, the 110th and 11th U.S. Colored Infantry were captured in Sulphur-Trestle, Alabama, by Nathan Bedford Forrest. And of course, I'm thinking, not that Nathan Bedford Forrest.
The famous Confederate general.
Yes, the Confederate general and founder later in life of the Klan. Earlier in life, he was a slave trader. He talked about the fact that when they started moving the prisoners, suddenly they recognized they were close to home and they escaped. This was also confirmed in the service record of Cephas Bass and Braxton Bass and Henry and Emmanuel, that they were taken prisoner and escaped and rejoined the regiment.
But you're right. It is, I mean, it really points to the care that you took in that story.
Yes.
To separate out what was speculation from what you could
clearly
actually prove in the records, because if you just hypothesized the story,
right,
that, oh yes, General Nathan Bedford Forrest allowed these four black soldiers to escape, that would make no sense.
It also made no sense because in the record he said that the general pulled the four of them apart from the other prisoners and made them sleep near his tent. My question was, why would a general worry about enlisted men in an enemy army? But the answer was where they were from. They were slaves of Major John Bass. And this is General Nathan Bedford Forrest. They were friends. They knew him. Braxton was a blacksmith, had probably shoed horses for before the war. There was some acknowledgement. I think, now this is speculation on my part, he recognized them. And as a result, when they got close to their home,
he looked the other way.
Yeah, because
and that is that's your speculation.
Well, enhanced by the official record that says that Forrest, this is 6 months after the Fort Pillow massacre, when he was just highly criticized for that massacre,
and massacre 6 months of black soldiers.
And then suddenly, his official stance was then, let's try and return them to their owners, and so. That was also part of the official record that was his stance
October '64. Professor Williams, I listened to this, and we have just a few minutes left, and I know some of our listeners will want suggestions either of you could make about how they can search out family. But often when I read these heartbreaking newspaper ads in your book, it seems like there's so little information available about those families, those enslaved people when they came out of slavery. And then something like Angela Walton Raji puts together, all of a sudden it seems like, actually, you can tell a story. It's a glass half full, half empty, I guess. But how do you think people should think about it? That there is a lot of information to be had, or that information is fairly rare and therefore precious?
Well, I think it's definitely precious. And I mean, Angela and I do two different kinds of work.
Right.
And for some of the people I mentioned in my book, in fact, I met some women in Atlanta who are genealogists who've taken some of the ads and are going and trying to find those people in records. But I'm trying to tell a broader story. And so I don't stop and do I do that for a few people who I'm especially curious about. But so I tend to get lots of little fragments. I may get a whole 100-page narrative, slave narrative, but there's only, I don't know, a paragraph about separation or two paragraphs. And so I get bits and pieces, but I'm trying to tell this broader story, and so I put lots of bits and pieces together. I think that some people who are really adept at this, you know, and you have in your studio one of the best at it, can really dig and find material. And especially if people went through the Union Army, if they enlisted and then if they filed for a pension, they can find material. But for other people, I think it's very, very difficult because people, enslaved people sometimes showed up in a planter's journal, possibly with a first name, you know. And so there were not official.
And as you point out, even names could be changed by an owner or changed by a person who escaped.
Right.
Angela Walton Raji, let me ask you, what advice do you give people who are looking at wanting to start tracing their families?
Well, I always tell people, of course, begin with yourself. Many people will, you know, call me up and say, hey, is it possible that I can, you know, find out what slave ship my ancestors came on? And, you know, I say, hold it. You know, you're not even at the beach, so don't get to the ship yet. Let's deal with what you have close at hand. Start with yourself. Explore the family archives, which you may think you may not have, but if you have photo albums, old papers, certificates, diplomas, yearbooks, you have a family archive. If there is someone in the family who goes to everyone's funeral, they have funeral programs, probably a stack of them, probably a shoebox full. That's part of the family archives as well. And also talk to the elders, listen to them, let them tell their stories. And if one is perhaps a bit older and may say, well, all the elders are gone, I'm the elder. Well, then write your story. Write what you know.
Write it down.
Tell the stories of the people that you knew when you were children who were your elders when you were younger. Get as much information down. And then you're probably ready to go outside the home. And I know I'm not so naive to think that everyone's going to go to the library or the archives. I know they're going to turn on the computer and try and get on one of the subscription sites. But before you do that, start with what's close at hand. Start with yourself.
Wonderful advice. We have just like a half minute left, and there, I take your point, Professor Williams, that you and Angela Walton Raji do very different work. But you cite a proverb from a Yoruba proverb that I think applies to both of you.
Yes.
Can you tell us that and why it inspires you?
Who cites it? I
did. You did, yeah. Well, yeah, I found it, and I'm not sure I have it in front of me. It was, it was something
proverb.
To the effect of no ancestor ever dies until no one is left
to call their name.
Okay, that's yeah.
And it just seemed as if finding the names that you're finding is something that is common to both of your work in terms of keeping these elders alive in some way.
Right.
I really appreciate both of your talking to us. Dr. Heather Williams is a professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She wrote the book, Help Me to Find My People, The African-American Search for Family Lost in Slavery. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Professor Williams will be in Baltimore tomorrow for an event at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. More information available on the Midday page at WIPR.org. And thank you, Angela Walton Raji.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
She's a genealogist, an author, and blogger. Her podcast is available at AfricanRootsPodcast.com. And if you're interested in attending the genealogy class at the Historical Society of Baltimore County Almshouse in Cockeysville, we have a link to that on the Midday page as well. I want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guests. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Be with us again Monday on Midday. Thousands of Marylanders attend for-profit colleges and career schools. How are they getting their money's worth? That's Monday on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you don't get burned by any April Fool's pranks, and I hope you have a wonderful weekend.